Thank you to everyone for joining our Clubhouse room today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society senior scholar, Robert Trzezinski. I think that Rob and the other scholars are very brave to do these Ask Me Anythings. We want to encourage people here in the room to ask questions. So if you raise your hand, we'll bring you up. I have questions that'll come in through, that come in through Instagram as well. If I can ask everyone willing to share the room with the share button at the bottom of the screen or the three dots up top to increase engagement for these. We are recording this for educational purposes. Rob, thanks as always. Any opening thoughts with things at current events, or would you prefer I just jump right into the questions?
Well, one of the big things I was thinking of course, is what's going on in Ukraine. I don't know how much of general interest this is, but the Ayn Rand Institute just put up a statement about the various schisms over the year that I found to be, I've given it a quick once over and found to be interesting, but I don't know if that's too much inside baseball. So I really just want to let people in the audience steer the questions wherever they want to go.
Okay, sure. Well, I happen to baseball stuff, but we'll at least defer to some of the Instagram people. I thought this one was interesting right off the bat from Hand Sanitizer Hoarder was their screen name. Who would you have be president after Biden?
Oh, dear goodness. Okay, so one thing I would put in here is I have a low bar for presidents because there's really not been a single one in my lifetime that was really outstanding. I mean, we got Reagan was the best, but he even had, sort of he looks great in retrospect compared to all the jerks we've had since then. But, if you talk to conservatives for a while there, I used to refer to him as St. Ronald of Reagan because there was a sort of hagiographic memory of him, but he had his flaws, he had his downsides. He was the best we've had. Usually they're pretty terrible people. Now, so this goes to a thesis I've had for a while, which is that what we're living through in the last 10 or 15 years is what I call 20th century light, which is we relive all the same mistakes of the 20th century, just in a shorter and shallower recap. And if we're doing a recap of the 20th century, I think where we are right now is probably more like the 1970s trending into the 1980s. And, because we had inflation, all we need to start, I saw something that the Love Boat is back for something. Oh, I thought one of the cruise lines was having a cruise where they had some of the old cast members, and I mean old cast members from the Love Boat on the cruise. It was like this 30th anniversary or 40th anniversary thing for the Love Boat. So it's like you got the Love Boat back, you've got inflation, you've got America retreating in a war, I mean, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. So you have all these sort of 1970s feeling kind of things happening. And one of them is, of course, Russia launching an aggressive war. So hopefully we're heading into the 80s. But the big question there is, in the late 1970s, everything was really, really terrible. But we had Ronald Reagan waiting in the wings, ready to come and be president and be one of the better presidents. So that question would boil down to then, who is the Ronald Reagan waiting in the wings? And the answer is, I wish I knew. I mean, I've been sort of joking that Mitt Romney should run again, because he's the one who got this issue of Russia as our geopolitical ally so incredibly right. I mean, that famous, infamous exchange that he had with Obama in the 2012 election, that during one of the debates where he said Russia is our number one geopolitical enemy. And Obama scoffed and said, look, the 1980s are calling them. They want their foreign policy back. The 1980s are calling, and we probably do want their foreign policy back. So the question, so Mitt Romney is the person I would look to, but I don't think that's going to happen. And he's not that inspiring outside of foreign policy. Of the younger people, I mean, there are a couple, like maybe Ben Sasse, that I would like, but, the problem is they're all politicians, and I don't see anybody who's waiting in the wings to come save us. And I think that looking for the right person to get elected president, it'd be nice to have somebody who's not a complete idiot elected president. It hasn't happened in a while. But you know, that does make a difference. But I think instead of looking for the right person to get elected president, we need to, the big lesson I've taken out of the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, and it's a lesson that I think we got out of the 70s, is what happened in the 1970s that made the 1980s possible is there was a kind of intellectual revolution on the right. There was an intellectual revival that happened. And I think it was primarily led by, it was partly the influence of Ayn Rand, who was out there and whose books had become very popular and had a big impact on a lot of people. And it was also, it was that combined with, I think Richard Salzman had the theory once that it was the, I may be putting words in his mouth, but as I recall, it was that the bicentennial made a big difference. You know, 1976, the 200th anniversary of the founding of America, there was this tremendous revival of study of and interest in the founding fathers that also had this incredibly beneficial impact on the culture and specifically on intellectuals within the right. They went back and studied Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and James Madison and John Locke and all the people who were the intellectual influences in the American Revolution. And that is sort of the revolution that preceded the Reagan Revolution, right? So, you know, who became president was less important than the fact that there was an intellectual revival of the right. And I think that's what we need today to make, you know, to create the environment in which, first of all, that somebody better can get elected president, and that being elected president, he can actually do the things that we would like somebody to do. And what we need is to have that intellectual revival, which I think has sort of, you know, the intellectual revival that happened in the 60s and 70s and 80s with the conservative and libertarian movement had sort of petered out by the 2010s. And I think we're experiencing the consequences of that loss of momentum. We need to have a revival of the revival. So that's my long answer to a short question.
That's good stuff. Lawrence, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Rob, thank you for this. Always excited to hear your opinions. I wanted to get your take on, it just happened this morning, but Biden gave a press sort of conference regarding the situation in Ukraine and the blocking of import of Russian oil. But in that same skew, he made sort of this, not threat, but definitely sort of he's going to come after, you know, oil producers here in the States, sort of accusing them of price gouging and other such efforts. And as someone who is from Texas and Houston, which is a very big in oil and gas, this kind of raises some alarm bells in my head. And I'm curious if you think anything serious would be done by Biden to our oil industry, or more of the same old, same old?
Well, okay. So, yeah, that's a great question. So this reflects the fact that the big picture here is that, you know, the dependence of the world on Russian oil and gas, and it's not America really that's dependent on it. It's Europe that's dependent on it. I mean, the Germans had one of those things where, like, for 20 years, everybody was warning them, look, you're pursuing policies that are going to make you totally dependent on natural gas from Germany, from Russia. And everybody's warning them and warning them and warning them. And then in the last, you know, couple months, they suddenly wake up and say, oh my God, we're dependent on natural gas from Russia. Like, this is, you know, like nobody ever warned them that this would happen. So they sort of went to it. They just couldn't help themselves. And this is going to be the pattern we're going to see, which is this current crisis sort of makes it clear that everybody else should be doing the maximum they can to extract oil and gas so that we don't have to get any of it from Russia. Right, the more we're producing in America, the Western Europe has its own reserves. They used to be net exporters. Britain has some reserves. There's all sorts of places they can get oil and gas without going to Russia, but they've been restricting their own ability to produce it. And we have been restricting it to some extent, a lesser extent here in the U.S. I mean, we've had the fracking revolution, and we have become, you know, net exporters by a good margin, and despite some complaints. So there's a bit of misinformation going out there where some people on the right are saying, you know, that Biden has stopped us from producing gas. Well, he actually hasn't. He's only been in office for a certain period of time. He hasn't achieved that much legislatively. There's all sorts of limits to what he can do. So we actually have not decreased our production of oil and gas in the U.S. It's actually up in the last year or two.
So, you know, it's but if he had his way, the policies Biden is beholden to would restrict our ability to produce gas. So that it's presented people with this very stark choice where it's like you either have to, you know, accept being dependent or accept having, you know, Russia have this source of wealth that they can use to basically escape the consequences of their dictatorship, or we can encourage our own production of gas and oil. And also, you know, things like Germans should not shut down their nuclear power plants, so they're not dependent on gas for heating and energy. But because it presents such a stark choice, the problem is it's presenting this choice to people who are absolutely beholden to the green religion, to the environmentalist dogmas that says, no, fracking is horrible, it's evil. Nuclear power is horrible, it's evil. And if you want to plumb the rationality of that, you really can't. It really is, it's like a religious creed. You know, so, I mean, if the big bogeyman we're concerned about is global warming, this is something I pointed out recently, that if you look at what's happened in America in the last 20 years, 20 to 30 years, we've actually decreased our carbon dioxide emissions. And we didn't do it the main way we did it. It wasn't because of solar, it wasn't because of wind, it wasn't because of nuclear, because we haven't built nuclear. If you look at how we did it, it's because we moved a lot of our electricity production from coal to natural gas. And natural gas, for various reasons, produces less carbon dioxide emissions, you know, per amount of energy produced than coal does. So it's primarily by moving over to natural gas, which we could do because we have this giant fracking revolution. But, you know, if global warming was your big concern, then you'd think people, you know, the top priority would be saying, yes, let's have more fracking, let's do more stuff with natural gas, and let's do more stuff with nuclear. But if you look at the environmentalists, fracking and nuclear power are the two things they will never, ever, ever over their dead bodies allow. So this is, you know, it's precisely because this war in Ukraine presents us with such a choice about what we're going to do in energy that the people who are beholden to this green religion, and Biden is definitely one of them, not that he think personally believes it, but, you know, he's a politician. He answers to the base of his party, and the base of his party is committed to this. So they have to come up with some other explanation for why gas is so expensive. They have to come up with some other explanation for how we're going to power our economy if we don't have, if we're not using Russian oil and gas. So the two things I see them doing is they are doubling down on the Green New Deal fantasies, which is this idea that somehow we're going to turn on a dime and power everything with solar and wind, which, you know, Germany's been trying this, and that's how they got where they are right now. They've been trying to pour this enormous amount of effort into using wind and solar power and shutting down all the nuclear plants, shut down all the coal plants. And what ends up happening is that wind and solar are not reliable and cannot be reliable sources of energy. You know, they're depending on the wind blowing and the sun shining, which is not a predictable and regular thing. So, but, you know, but the so the big thing is that the whole bunch of people are doubling down on the idea that, no, if we just try harder, this failed policy will work. It's a very popular position. If we just try harder, this failed policy will work. And then the second thing you see them doing is what Biden's doing, which is rising prices are a conspiracy by greedy corporations, you know, as if corporations were never greedy when the prices were going down. Somebody did a great graph on making fun of this about the greed versus generosity cycle, you know, and showing a graph of some other commodity, a graph of prices, and rocking out, well, you know, where the prices are going up, that's when corporations were greedy. I mean, the prices are going down, that's when corporations were generous. So now we've understood the whole situation, which isn't, you know, it's taking it to the reduction to absurdity. But again, it's people falling back, as politicians tend to do, falling back on whatever their comfort zone is, whatever their sort of comfortable pre-existing ideology is. So if your pre-existing ideology is environmentalism, you say, oh, we have to do more renewable energy. If your pre-existing ideology is anti-capitalism, you say, oh, if prices are going up, it's greedy big corporations. So it's people trying to deal with the new situation by falling back on old dogmas.
Interesting. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for that. And again, if anyone wants to come up, just raise your hand. We'll be glad to bring you up. Next is Roger. Roger, I haven't seen you since you were on the podcast last week. I meant to tell you it was fun. Go ahead with your question for Rob.
Yeah, thanks for having me on there. That was great. And Rob, my question is right along the lines of what Lawrence is talking about, but more specifically, aside from just oil, are we headed towards price controls? And is there anybody in Congress that could step up and provide a wall against price controls? It feels like that's where we're.
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a push for it. I mean, there's I talked about living through 20th century light, and it sort of feels that has that sort of feeling like all the old dogmas that you thought were discredited suddenly pop back into life, like zombies coming up out of the grave, right? So you thought price controls were an old discredited idea, and then suddenly you have a bunch of people walking around saying, "Oh no, price controls would totally work. Let me give you this, you know, economics flimflam about how it would work." It's one of these ideas that you thought had been rejected and sort of, I mean, you know, the canonical example of the failure of price controls was rent control in New York City in the 70s. And, you know, because you had roaring inflation, rents were going up uncontrollably. And so they had rent control. You had rent controlled apartments. And what happened, of course, is that owners who had rent controlled apartments, who had to basically charge the same rent they were charging in like 1958, even when that made no economic sense, they had no incentive to maintain the apartment buildings. They had no money, no profits with which to do repairs. And so you had these rent-controlled apartments and buildings that were falling apart that had poor security during the great crime wave of the 70s, buildings that were, you know, in bad repair that were falling apart. And you had this great example of how when you impose rent control, price controls, you know, the quality of the product goes down. And you had whole apartment buildings that were abandoned by their owners, essentially, because there was no way profitably to rent them out. And so you had all sorts of one example after another of price controls being imposed, leading to shortages, leading to poor quality products, et cetera. So you thought this whole thing was, you know, totally refuted. And somebody just did a poll of economists, and something like, you know, 85% of economists say, no, for God's sake, price controls is a terrible idea. My favorite is University of Chicago. This is where I went to school. There was somebody in the economics department put on an economics 101 quiz, a question of like, you know, such and such a person has proposed price controls. How would a real economist respond to this? I love that phrase, real economist. You know, like a real economist would know that this is a bad idea. All right. So, but is there anybody who can stop it? It just shows the power of these sort of undead ideas that people will not, something can be thoroughly refuted and people will not want to give up on it. You know, is there anybody who can stop it? Well, I think there's a lot of people who can stop it. I mean, we just had the great big, giant free spending, Biden agenda come crashing against two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, Joe Manchin from West Virginia. And all the indications are that this fall is not going to be a good election for Democrats, because, you know, they did what Democrats always, they did what everybody always does, which is they assume that because you won one election by the skin of your teeth, that you have the mandate of heaven. And the people are on your side, and you can pursue your ultimate, most extreme fantasy agenda, and that's basically what Democrats tried to do. And it never works; it always fails. But they always try it. So they're going to get a backlash for that. And of course, you know, inflation being up. I mean, the economy is actually doing very well. Employment is up because of the strong bounce back from the pandemic. So all the economic conditions are good. But the thing about inflation that they've been in denial on is that inflation takes a good economy and makes it look bad. So, you know, with inflation, with the disruption from the war, it looks like it's going to be a bad fall, a bad November this year for the Democrats. So I'm not too worried that they're going to come up with a giant scheme for price controls and then impose that. But they are going to jawbone the idea. They're going to talk about it a lot. And the reason they're going to do it is because there is this tremendous audience for it. on the base of the Democratic Party, you know, the base, the core supporters of the Democratic Party, the idea of blaming everything on corporate greed goes over really well. And the basic problem that both parties have right now is basically assuming that they assume that Twitter is real life, right? That the most fanatical base members of your party represents the majority of the American people. And so you're talking to the fanatical base and you're not talking to the independent voters. So that's why they're going to keep talking about it a lot. I also think for the same reason, that's why they're not actually going to be able to implement it.
All right. Good stuff. Well, you know, you alluded to inside baseball and the article. One of the things that came up is who has the right to speak for Ayn Rand. This is tangentially related. Dimentius says, do you think Ayn Rand would advocate intervening in Ukraine?
Oh, God. Okay. So first thing, that's an interesting question. I want to talk about Ukraine a little. But I want to talk about the form of the question, because I think it's a sort of a mistaken, the question is asked in a mistaken form, which is, I have absolutely no idea what Ayn Rand would advocate doing about Ukraine. I shouldn't say absolutely no idea. I can sort of project where she might have had the sympathies for. But, you know, she hasn't commented on anything in modern politics since her death. One of the things that happened is a couple of articles that popped up recently about Ayn Rand. I'm like, why is this happening? Well, I guess we're right around the 40th anniversary of her death. This week. And so I think objectivists weren't celebrating this because, you know, the anniversary of her death is not the thing we're interested in. We're interested in the anniversary. We occasionally celebrate the anniversary of her birth or the anniversary of one of her novels coming out. But apparently some people out there, including some of the usual suspects, the critics of Ayn Rand, decided that the 40th anniversary of her death was something to write about. The only good one I've seen so far is Kathy Young, who's a friend of mine, she just has something in the Bulwark, a long article where she's somewhat critical of Ayn Rand, but it's one of the best, it's one of the best responses I've seen in terms of somebody who's not an objectivist, but who, you know, has some knowledge of it, who speaks about it intelligently, who doesn't repeat a lot of the same old smears. So I recommend that. It just came out, I think, this morning in the Bulwark from Kathy Young. Anyway, but the point of all this is that it's been 40 years since Ayn Rand was around and since she commented on anything. And even when she was around, some of the things I think she was wrong about. You know, she was very critical of Ronald Reagan, and his presidency turned out tremendously well, despite the flaws that it had. I actually personally think, you know, it's very, very minor things, but I think she was at her weakest when commenting about war. Some of the things she said about World War II, because I think it wasn't a topic she understood really well or was all that interested in. You know, she wasn't somebody who was interested in war. She was interested in, you know, people building steel mills and running transcontinental railroads. But I just want to put that proviso of, you know, when people say, what would Ayn Rand think of? And then put some very, very specific contemporary thing. You know, I think it's a wrong outlook to say to try to project what she would say exactly about it. Now, I'll say a couple things about that, though, which is I think she would have understood Vladimir Putin thoroughly, backwards and forwards, having come out of the Soviet Union. Oh, thanks for somebody put up the link to Kathy's piece here. Thanks for doing that. So Ayn Rand would have understood Vladimir Putin totally thoroughly. He was exactly the sort of thing. He was lieutenant colonel in the KGB. He's exactly the sort of person that she saw rising to power in the Soviet Union in the early days when she was there. So she would have understand that kind of power lusting personality thoroughly. She had some sympathies with what in her day was the quote unquote America first outlook in foreign policy. Now I hesitate to say that because a lot of what passes for America first today is very different. And some of it is, you know, I've seen this in the last couple of weeks, is just outright sympathy for Vladimir Putin. Because there are certain conservatives, American conservatives, who see Putin in his more recent incarnations, his post-KGB incarnation, they see him as a defender of sort of Christian nationalism. Right? So the fact that he has basically made this Attila and the Witch Doctor alliance with the Kirill, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, they've got the sort of Attila and the Witch Doctor partnership going on. There's a bunch of American conservatives who love that, and they think that's great. That's the model for what America should do. And so some of them have been very sympathetic to Putin, and they've given and they've done this under sort of America First rubric, which I think is completely backwards because it's so un-American. But Ayn Rand in her day was very much sympathetic to sort of the America First approach, which was against large-scale American intervention abroad. And in this case, I mean, my one sympathy for that is I think we absolutely have an interest in seeing Vladimir Putin lose in Ukraine, because he represents an attempt to spread a sort of kleptocratic, sort of neo-totalitarian dictatorship, and to spread that throughout Europe. And he also represents an attempt to spread warfare and conquest and rule by force, a sort of might makes right approach to geopolitics. He's bringing that back to Europe. And given the history of Europe, that's absolutely terrible. The one thing I will say, though, is that it's in our interest to see him fail, but it's way more in the interest of the Europeans to see them fail. And the one thing I think is most positive development coming out, and it's absolutely a shock to me because I didn't think they had it in them, is that Europe has really grasped this. And they have shown a way more leadership than I expected them to show in terms of, you know, having Europe unite and impose. They've imposed sanctions I never thought the Germans would be willing to impose. The Swiss are freezing the bank accounts of Putin cronies, of the so-called oligarchs in Russia. And, you know, if as I put it out recently, if the supervillains can't hide their money in a Swiss bank account, where can they hide it? So all these sort of unprecedented things, the Swedes have, Sweden has been neutral, officially neutral in every conflict since 1939, when they helped the Finns against Russia. They've been neutral in every conflict since then. They just broke that neutrality to support Ukraine. So the Europeans have really stepped up to the plate. And so the great thing is, I think what America should be doing is it should be basically supporting and encouraging and backstopping the Europeans. So one example, for example, is the Poles have, Poland has considered giving some of its old fighter jets to Ukraine. And this is, makes total sense, because what's happening is that the Poles, our newer NATO allies in Eastern Europe, have a whole bunch of old Soviet-era hardware. They've been slowly replacing it with NATO hardware, with, you know, Western, with F-35s and F-16s. And so it makes perfect sense for them to say, well, look, all these old MiGs that we have that we're going to be getting rid of, we're moving away from, we should send those, we can send those to Ukraine. But what they want to have is a guarantee that if we get rid of a bunch of our fleet, America will give us F-16s that we can then use to, so we're not weakening our own defenses. So that's a perfect thing that we should be doing. And there's some work being done on this, and maybe it's going to happen, to say, okay, the Poles give a bunch of their MiGs to Ukraine, we give a bunch of F-16s to the Poles, and that's what we, one of the things we can do to help the Europeans help the Ukrainians. And I think that's exactly the approach we should be taking. You know, and it's the old Cold War rules too, that we can't send American troops and boots on the ground. We can't send American planes to do a no-fly zone, because that would involve a direct, you know, one-on-one conflict between nuclear powers that risks nuclear war. Nobody has an interest in risking nuclear war. So I think what we should do, and what we're probably going to do, is we're going to stay there in the background. We're going to be the support for the Europeans. The Europeans who have the really direct interest in this are going to take center stage. And that's, I think, as it should be.
That's interesting. I'm curious if, you know, the Ukrainians have the pilots, if it's the plausible mm-hmm. deniability that it's not really the West flying them as well.
one thing that's happening, though, is there are a lot of, there's been like 40,000 military veterans from the U.S., some from the U.S., some from Britain, some from Canada, some, and a lot of Czechs and Poles who have been volunteering to go fight. So you're going to have these sort of volunteer brigades where they're not official, they're not serving under the NATO flag or under the British flag or under the Polish flag, but they're going to be pouring into the battlefield. So you're going to have, you know, it's going to get messy. But again, the old Cold War rules worked back in the day, and they still work again, which is, so long as you are not officially, you know, as NATO power is not officially doing anything, you keep that plausible deniability, and that, you know, you push the rules where you can. We can make this work. We did it in Afghanistan. We can do it here.
Thank you for that. Well, I want to again encourage people to raise your hand if you have any kind of questions for Rob. We still have a treasure trove of questions from Instagram. This one is interesting. It's from Sonia. What can objectivism offer young men who seem to be drawn to scholars like Jordan Peterson? Can this philosophy he offers be considered objectivist?
Okay, so Jordan Peterson, let me think about this. I'm not a big Jordan Peterson expert. I haven't really looked into him too much. What I have looked at, I've been kind of unimpressed. I just don't think there's all that much there. And I know I'm going to probably tick people off by saying that, because I know he has his very strong supporters. I think the Jordan Peterson phenomenon is definitely, though, somebody asked about young men, it's definitely has this tremendous appeal to young people in general, and I think especially to young men who are, you know, what you're doing in your youth. These are trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my life? What is it that gives meaning and purpose to my life? And he's been somebody, I think the whole key to his success is he has an answer to that, or at least he claims to have an answer to that. Now, my impression of him, like I said, I'm not a big Jordan Peterson expert, but my impression is it's a more traditional, conservative, self-sacrifice and religion kind of, in the background, at least. You know, he gets some, from what I understand of him, he gives some solid advice about, you know, basically get your life in order, find a purpose for your life, pull yourself together sort of kind of advice that he gives to young men that they need to hear. But I think that philosophically, I don't think he has something that is consistent with objectivism. And I think I don't think he has something that's really sufficient for being an answer to that question about what should I do with my life? What gives meaning to my life? And I've also found him to be a bit of there's this whole sort of, they called it the intellectual dark web a while back, and Peterson was considered one of the members of it. And there's this whole sort of contrarian media ecosystem, right, of guys who have podcasts or YouTube things or what have you, who are outside of academia or outside of the mainstream media, who are offering these sort of contrarian views on things. And oftentimes, I think that contrarianism just becomes sort of reflexive, and they're against whatever everybody else is for. And I've seen that with, you know, with certain topics where they'll just sort of go off the rails. And into conspiracy theories and things like that. Jordan Peterson isn't one of those, but he has some slightly goofy ideas, and he has fad diets that he keeps talking about. So I think there's a little bit of that sort of reflexive contrarianism to him that I don't particularly care for. But what I would say is this: I think that it does show, and where this question is right on target, is it does show there's this tremendous need for somebody to give an alternative answer. I've got a piece coming up. I might be doing it for one of these clubhouses. I know I've got an article in the works on this about the fact that, you know, one of the startling things that's happened in the last 30 years is that religiosity in America has declined. We're becoming a secular country, that church attendance is way down. The number of people who declare themselves nothing in particular when it comes to religion is way up. I think the nothing in particulars right currently outnumber the evangelical Christians for the first time. So there's this tremendous sort of collapse of intellectual, of religious belief, and also of religious communities. You know, even people who still nominally believe in God don't go to church anymore. So that creates this tremendous gap, and I think that's a lot of what we're dealing with. There's a tremendous gap of people saying, well, if religion isn't there to provide an explanation and provide a sense of meaning and purpose for your life, then what do we have? And the answer is that the secular answers have been actually pretty terrible on the whole. So you have a lot of people who have, especially on the left, what you see in the modern left and the sort of the woke left is a bunch of people who have basically said, well, we don't have religion, so let's look to identity politics to provide meaning or purpose to my life.
in the same way that religion did. Or let's look to environmentalism, or let's look to political left-wing political activism in general, is their version of going to church, right? Is the thing that gives you a sense of community, a sense of meaning, a sense of belonging, a sense of having some purpose to your life. And when you look at what the other secular alternatives are, there's not a lot offered there. And I think guys like Jordan Peterson have risen up as a way to try to provide some answer to that. I don't think his answer, from what I understand it, is really sufficient. I think Ayn Rand has a terrific answer. So I've written about this a couple times. I'll be doing more on this in the future, which is one of the things that jumps out for me is in The Fountainhead, there's a scene where Howard Rourke explains to you the meaning of life. And it's really interesting because it's not really quite Ayn Rand's style that she uses everywhere else, where somebody actually says, here's the meaning of life. And Howard Rourke comes out, he's talking to Gail Wind, and he says, here's the meaning of life. And he pulls, I think, a branch down from a tree, and he bends it. He says, now, you know, I've taken this down from the tree. I can make what I want of it. I can make a bow out of it. I can make a railing. I can make a cane. I can make a weapon, a tool. I can do whatever. I can take the whatever's given to me in nature. I can take it and I can make something of it that serves, you know, the needs of human life. And she said, that's the meaning of life, your work and what you can achieve with the material given to you by nature. That's the meaning of life. And that scene has always stuck with me. And it is the answer that Ayn Rand has to offer, which is what I call a culture of achievement. The idea where, you know, you should be looking at the world the way Howard Rourke does in that moment, where you look around at what is the material available to me out here in the world, and how can I go create something and build something and achieve something that will make human life, that will improve my life and make human life in general better. And so that idea of having a secular source of meaning in life, of meaning and especially of purpose in life, I think is really desperately needed. And it's going to be more and more desperately needed as we become a secular country. And we need something other than, you know, religion religious ethics or some watered down version of that to sustain, to give people that sense of meaning in life.
Good stuff. Thank you. Bill, do you have a question for Rob? If you want to unmute yourself.
There we go. Okay. I managed to be late to the discussion about protests the other week. And that meant that I did not get to put in my point of view there. So I will try to phrase a prior question, which informs my thinking about this, which is, what do you look to in a society, a mixed society like ours, to determine the legitimacy of that society? And the answer that I personally have is that you look to the nature of the courts. Do they provide essentially the services that Rand says that you've got to have in a government? That is to say, dispensing of justice in a reasonably timely way and in a just way. To me, the answer to that question is a precondition to deciding the questions about protests and the like. So you have my answer in very brief, but what would your answer be?
Oh, okay. So, the question of the legitimacy of a society, basically the legitimacy of a form of government. What you said about the courts, I think is terrific, because, you know, we're all dealing right now with the consequences of Vladimir Putin basically recreating a dictatorship in Russia, sort of lapsing back into, it's like the Soviet, it's like, you know, actually, I mentioned Kathy Young's piece earlier, and she had a really interesting observation on that about how Ayn Rand, you know, came out of the Soviet Union, you know, criticizing the Soviet, the secular dictatorship of the Soviets, but also opposing the religious traditionalism of, you know, the old Russian system. And Kathy makes the point that now we're dealing with Vladimir Putin, somebody who has combined all the worst qualities of both systems, right? He's bringing back the old sort of Soviet style dictatorship combined with
the religious traditionalism of the Tsarist era. So one of the key steps that he in that, and one of the key warning signs that I saw very early on, was there were a number of politically motivated prosecutions of his political enemies. So there's a guy named Khodorkovsky, who was, I think, in 2003, 2004, somewhere in there. It's been a while, so I'm trying to get the exact dates here. But this is early in the 2000s. There was Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was one of these quote-unquote oligarchs, but he was one of the better ones. He was somebody who had risen up in the post-Soviet system, had become a billionaire running an oil company, and he was trying to move things. He was known for trying to move things more towards the rule of law and having, you know, cleaning up the books of the oil company and making sure that they were the books were kept according to sort of Western standards, where you could actually tell where the money was going and who was getting it, as opposed to everything just being a slush fund for the political insiders. And because of that, Putin considered him a rival, and then started this sort of politically motivated prosecution of him. And basically at every step of that prosecution, it was clear that the courts were controlled by the regime, or that the regime was really clamping down on the independence of the courts, that if you went into a courtroom, you could not get a fair hearing. The verdict was determined ahead of time by, you know, by the people in power. And so that was one of the key indications. So I think definitely the courts are there. I would also say freedom of speech, because, you know, there are also systems where things are very bad, but you can be improving them. You know, there's a room to improve them. There's the ability to change and reform them. And here's where I think Ukraine comes in as a great example, because I had this interesting discussion a while back with just last week with Stephen about Ukraine and the Russian invasion. And one of the things he pointed out is that on, you know, indexes of official corruption and things like that, Ukraine and Russia are pretty much at the same level. So how can you tell between them? And I said, the big difference is that in Ukraine, the current president of Ukraine, Zelensky, Volodymyr Zelensky, got elected because he basically was out ranting and raving about official corruption and vowing to improve it. And he had the freedom to do so. He had the freedom. He actually had, you know, it's funny, he became president because he created a TV show in which he was the fictional president of Ukraine. And the whole point of the TV show was railing against official corruption and trying to, you know, root out official corruption and improve it. And it was on the basis of that that people said, yes, we want that, so let's elect him to be the real president of Ukraine. So Ukraine had enough, the difference in Ukraine and Russia is Ukraine had enough freedom of speech that somebody could become famous by railing against official corruption and promising to clean it up, and then get elected into office by doing that. So I think freedom of speech, free elections, and the courts are sort of the three, if you want to talk about the high ground of a free society, those are the three things that you have to have. And of those, I think freedom of speech is, I always signal out because, of course, I'm a writer, right? Freedom of speech is the thing that allows me to operate. But of course, it exists. It can only really, freedom of speech can only really happen to the extent that you have also, you know, the courts being objective, that somebody can't bring a bogus prosecution against me for some non-crime where the verdict is decided ahead of time. And also, you know, it can only, free speech can only have its impact to the extent that also that we have free elections and are able to elect our rulers. So those three things are very closely connected. And those I would describe as the high ground of a free society. And if you have those, then you have the ability to have peaceful process make a difference and have an impact and be able to, you know, to influence. You can use those mechanisms to influence other voters and hopefully, you know, get them to make the right decisions.
All right. We'll try to get as many of the last five questioners as possible.
Yes. Philip,
go ahead and unmute yourself if you have a question for Rob. Philip?
Yeah, just briefly, it's a big question, but Rob, what... I'm thoroughly interested in objectivism. but also seeking to understand how it can coexist, if you will, with faith. Specifically, I'm a Catholic and I appreciate my faith, but also see a lot of great merits in objectivism. And so could you speak to that just briefly?
Okay, that's a great question.
Thank you.
And I'll try to be brief because I know we got a lot of callers. I'm going back to the talk radio format. A lot of callers waiting in the line. Scott, you're the host. Anyway, the quick thing is, the quick answer is, objectivism is not compatible with faith. Objectivism per se as a philosophy is not compatible with faith. Because Ayn Rand argued that, you know, the only way to understand the world is through reason, that faith always implies a certain, you know, a certain degree of willful blindness. They're basically saying, and I've observed this, long before I became an objectivist, I became an atheist, you know, when I was very young. And I noticed that I had friends who were brought up in strongly religious backgrounds, and they had like little walls that there were certain things they couldn't bring themselves to think about, certain questions they couldn't bring themselves to ask, because that went against the thing that they were supposed to have faith in, and they specifically, not just the idea they had faith, but they were taught, and this is a particular version of religion, they were taught essentially that it was a sin to doubt. And so if it's a sin to doubt, there's certain questions you can't even ask because that would lead you into doubting, and you're supposed to have faith. Now, I will also say, that is not every version of religion, and there are older traditions that I think objectivism is closely related to. One of the things I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion recently about the Enlightenment and the intellectual legacy of the Enlightenment, and I think that you could definitely view objectivism as an outgrowth of the philosophical trends and philosophical aspirations of the Enlightenment. We're very much in that, objectivism is very much in that tradition. And I've been doing a lot of reading recently about, among the founding fathers especially, there was a particular version of religion. It was called, the general term for it was natural religion. And it was the idea, this comes out of John Locke, who wrote a book called The Reasonableness of Christianity. It came from, a friend of mine is a historian who's done some great work on a guy named Jonathan Mayhew, who was a Boston preacher who was hugely influential on John Adams and a couple of the other revolutionaries in Boston, who was an advocate of this same sort of outlook. And it's the idea that the precepts of religion should be developed from observation of nature and reasoning, and basically secular philosophical reasoning. So it was this very Enlightenment sort of thing that you maintained something that was nominally religious, but the idea was that, well, God implanted us with a faculty for reason, so therefore he expected that we should use it, and therefore reason should decide all issues having to do with our religious beliefs. So it's this sort of combination of secular Enlightenment rationality under the heading of religion, but it was a very Enlightenmentized version of religion. And I think, you know, the founding fathers all very much came out of that tradition. So it's something that's much closer to objectivism. It's almost like a halfway house to objectivism, or a stepping stone in this direction. So I do think there are versions of religion that are less clashing with objectivism, but it all comes down to that issue of, does the reliance of faith cause you to put up walls that say, I can't ask these questions, that it's a sin to doubt, I can't ask these questions, I can't entertain these certain ideas because of the importance of faith, where it's cutting you off from thinking about things and inducing that kind of blindness. And I think that's the real objectivist case against faith.
Hey, thanks for that answer, Rob. I appreciate it very much.
Hey Philip, this is Jag. I'm the CEO of the Atlas Society. I just wanted to jump in on that real briefly. I pinned a link to an op-ed that I wrote in the Wall Street Journal, Can You Love God and Ayn Rand? It's also reprinted on the Atlas Society site, in which I make the point that some of the most passionate fans of Rand, of Atlas Shrugged, of The Fountainhead, are also some of the most religious people I know. So, you know, I don't think the fact that Rand, her metaphysics and epistemology was one of the natural world and reason, not faith, should be a bar to further exploring the ideas, certainly enjoying the fiction. And then also, you know, just when you examine your own kind of religious commitments. I mean, I go to Chabad here in Malibu several times a year. And even though I'm an atheist, but I really enjoy the religious community and the experience. So just a little bit of food.
Well, and from my experience, there's nothing more common than a Jew who's an atheist. In college, I knew a guy who was the son of a rabbi and was always going off to temple. And I was shocked to discover, he said, well, no, I don't really believe in God. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I don't understand this, but I've discovered it is a huge phenomenon of all these people who they will still go to the ceremonies and the rituals and the sense of the being part of the Jewish community. But at the same time, you know, belief in God is kind of optional in certain congregations.
Yeah, I grew up Jewish myself, so I can relate. Clark, thank you for your patience. Do you have a question for Rob, if you can unmute yourself? Clark? All right, well, we're going to go to Alan then.
Hi, thanks. I think there's enough problems that one has to face in life that one can be both objective and be religious and never have to confront those two things. So mine right now is why, even after telling myself not to hit myself in the thumb with a hammer and be careful, I still managed to do that. But that's another subject. I wanted to ask, when you talked about those, the three things that you thought were most important, Rob, I'm wondering how much of that is the result of one's culture and where one lives in the world. And how it's maybe in other parts of the world, it's not so important. And I think we see that at least, and maybe this is a fair comparison, when the United States, for example, tries to import democracy to other parts of the world. So maybe that's a good question. I don't know, but that's all I could think of.
Right. Okay, that's an interesting angle. So one thing I would say about this is I would say that to tell it to people in Hong Kong, right? So Hong Kong is, I mean, the thing that strikes me as an answer to this idea that, well, maybe our, you know, version of liberal, quote unquote, liberal democracy, it's a somewhat imprecise term, but it's the most universally accepted one, you know, some version of representative government, free speech, rule of law, maybe that's just a Western thing. Maybe it's just a European thing. But, you know, I look out there and I see that some of the bravest and most passionate struggles for those ideals right now are happening outside of Europe, outside of what we consider, you know, Western or North American context. So one of the biggest ones is Hong Kong, where unfortunately, I think they're not going to succeed. They're just so outnumbered. But you know, now that the Xi Jinping regime has decided to crack down on freedom in Hong Kong, I don't think they're going to be able to stop them. But there has been this tremendously courageous resistance in Hong Kong to try to say we want to, you know, these Hong Kong is a place that benefited from, you know, 100 years basically of British rule and of the British bringing the best part of British rule there, which is, you know, courts that acted according to, you know, there's again this point about courts being important. They brought the British court system, the British common law, and impartial administration of the law in the courts, the recognition of property rights. All that is being swept away. They've been fighting for it tooth and nail in Hong Kong because they realize how important that is. and some of my observations about, you know, the importance of my observations of the importance of free speech is that China was a place where for about 20 years there was an attempt to use the relatively increased amount of freedom that they had in order to create a system that had more rule of law, more representation, not just in Hong Kong, but in mainland China. And what happened is that they couldn't create a non-corrupt system of government, primarily because they didn't have freedom of speech. That the minute you started exposing corruption, you were criticizing prominent government officials, and then you'd be clamped down on, right? And because they didn't have the rule of law, because they didn't have freedom of speech, they could not get rid of the endemic corruption of the system. And I think it's taking them to some very bad places right now. So I think that one of the things I've seen over the last, especially over the last 50, 60 years since World War II, has been that you've seen the quote unquote Western style of government become less and less exclusively Western, that there's all sorts of countries on the Pacific Rim who have adopted it. There are, all the bunch of countries in Eastern Europe that adopted it after the fall of the Soviet Union. So you've seen it spread out of and sort of refute the idea of it being purely a Western phenomenon. I think you're starting to see a little bit of it happened in South America. I think you're starting to see some of it happen in Africa. It's very slow and tortuous there. Because they're coming out of the period of dictatorship they had after the colonial, they went from colonialism to dictatorship, and they're basically trying to establish these institutions for the very first time ever in their history. But I think that the actual experience in the world sort of goes against the idea that somehow this does not have universal appeal. Now, the one thing I will say, though, is that you cannot go straight, things like our attempt to do this in Afghanistan indicate that you cannot go straight from basically what is practically a Stone Age society. I mean, Afghanistan was extremely primitive, one of the most isolated places in the world where the cultural preconditions, the cultural foundations of a free society it had not ever really been established. It was this sort of tribal society based on primitive codes of tribal vengeance. Overlaid on top of that, was a particularly primitive version of Islam, a particularly unreformed version of Islam. So you had a situation where you're not going to go into Afghanistan and 20 years later have it be a Jeffersonian democracy, as people like to say. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't do anything at all. It doesn't mean you can't have an outcome there that's better both for the people who live there and better for us in terms of the consequences for us. But it also is indicating that, there is a long, we're the inheritors of a long cultural road of thousands of years of development that brought the basic ideas and worked out how a free society works in practice and developed all the ideas that it required to create it. And that can be achieved in an astonishingly short period of time by the people who are coming afterwards. And so you've seen places like South Korea become free societies in very short periods of time. But it's still a very, very difficult thing to do. And it's going to be very hard to implant everywhere.
Good stuff. Well, I don't think we're going to have time for another question, but thanks to everyone who participated. TAS has two good events tomorrow. Jag, I believe, will be interviewing Kenny Zhu tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on the fight for meritocracy. And then at 8 p.m., Stephen Hicks will host a discussion of elitist versus working man socialism from George Orwell. And he's very good about taking questions. Rob, Jag, any final thoughts?
I just want to thank everybody.
I think we also have a clubhouse with Jason tomorrow.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you bringing that up.
It's. I recommend people try to join. He's doing a two-part series on objectivism and sexuality. So it should be really interesting.
Oh yeah, I might want to tune in for that because that could really be interesting when you get people asking about that.
Exactly. Well, Rob, thank you for answering these questions today, and again, thanks to everyone for participating.